8. The life process. I took a left fork in the walking trail behind Ani and Tashi's house and made my way up through the rocks and trees for almost a mile. Ani had ended our conversation abruptly, saying that she had to make some preparations that she would tell me about later, and I had decided to take a walk by myself. As I gazed out on the green foliage, questions filled my mind. Ani had said I needed to see how Shambhala models a culture focused on the life process. What did that mean? As I pondered the question, I noticed a man walking toward me on the path. He was older, appearing to be about 50, walking at a brisk pace. When he reached me, his eyes lingered on mine for a moment, and then he walked on by. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw him turn once and look back at me. I walked a bit further, irritated that I hadn't stopped and started the conversation. I turned around and headed back in the direction the man had been walking, hoping I could catch up with him. He was just rounding a corner up ahead and moving out of sight. When I got to the corner myself, he had disappeared altogether. I was disappointed, but walked back to Ani's house without thinking any more about it. She greeted me at the door with some jeans and a shirt. "You'll need these," she said. "Let me guess," I said. "You used your field to create these." She nodded. "You're beginning to understand us." I sat down in a chair and looked at her. I didn't feel as though I understood at all. "Tashi's father has arrived," she said. "Where is he?" I asked. "In with Tashi." She nodded toward a bedroom. "Where did he come from?" "He's been at the temples for a while." I perked up. "Did he just come in?" "Yes, just before you came back." "I think I passed him just now on the path." Ani paused, then said, "I think he is here to prepare us."
"For what?"
"For the transition. He thinks we are nearing the time when Shambhala will move." I was about to ask for more when I noticed she had looked away, appearing to be in deep thought. "You said you saw Tashi's father on the path?" she asked. I nodded. "Then the message he is bringing must be important for you, too. We have to be very conscious of the process here." She looked at me expectantly. "You mentioned the life process," I said. "Can you tell me exactly what those in Shambhala understand that to be?" She nodded. "Let's look at the whole picture of how a society can evolve once it begins to raise its level of prayer energy. The first thing that happens is that those who create the technology will begin to make it ever more efficient and automated, so that robots make more and more of the material goods in the society. This is already occurring in every industry in the outer cultures and is a positive development, despite the fact that it is especially dangerous. It can place too much power in the hands of a few individuals or corporations unless it is decentralized. It also creates job losses, and many people have to adjust how they make a living. What mediates these problems, however, is the fact that as material production is automated, the overall economy will begin to shift toward one of information and service, providing just the right information at just the right time for others, which will necessitate everyone becoming more intuitive and alert and focused on synchronistic perception as a way of life. As spiritual knowledge increases and people become aware of the creative power they can attain with their prayer fields, technology is evolved another step. That's when the thought wave amplifiers will be discovered so that individuals can create everything they need mentally. When this happens, the culture will be free to focus completely on spiritual matters, or what we call the life process itself. This is where we are now in Shambhala, and where the rest of human culture is destined to follow. Our whole society is educated to the wider reality of the spirit. At some point, every culture must truly grasp that we are spiritual beings, and that our bodies themselves are only atoms in a particular vibration, a vibration that can be raised as our connection and prayer power increase. Here in Shambhala, we understand that fact, and we also understand that we come down here from the purely spiritual plane to accomplish something. We come here on a mission to bring the whole world into full spiritual awareness, generation by generation, and to do it as consciously as possible. That's why we participate fully in this life process from the very beginning, before birth itself, in fact. She looked at me to see if I understood, then continued, "There is always an intuitive relationship between the mother and father and the unborn child before birth." "What kind of relationship?" I asked. She smiled. "Everyone here knows that souls begin to contact parents before conception. They make their presence known, especially with the mother. It's part of the process of deciding whether the prospective parent is actually the right one." I looked at her with astonishment. "This already occurs in the outer cultures," Ani explained. "It's just that people are only now beginning to talk about it and to develop their perception. Ask any group of mothers and see what they say." This same kind of intuition is involved in the marriage process as well, if you think about it. As humans learn to seek out a mate consciously, the main measure is passion, but that's not the only factor. We also get intuitions of what life will look like with a particular person. We assess whether we are fully conscious of it or not, if the style of life with that individual will represent an advance forward from the style and attitudes we ourselves grew up with. Do you see what I'm getting at? Choosing the right mate is important from an evolutionary point of view. As we evolve spiritually, humans are destined to mate consciously in order to set up a home or home attitude that represents a more truthful way of life compared to the previous generation. Intuitively, we know that we must build a life that adds to the wisdom we found in the world when we arrived. See the process? Then, when intuitions come in about a child who wants to be born to us, they always bring up questions. Why would this child want to be born to our family? What would this child want to be when he or she grows up? How would this child stretch and expand the understanding he or she found with us? Wait a minute, I said. Don't we have to be careful in assuming we know how our kids will turn out? What if we're wrong and we try to fit our children into some pigeonhole that isn't best for them? My mother thought I was going to be a country preacher, and that wasn't accurate. Yes, of course. These are only intuitions. The reality will only be close to what we think. It will never be exact. Centuries were spent arranging marriages and forcing children to enter professions chosen by their parents. But don't you see? This was the misuse of a real intuition. We can learn from what they did wrong. We don't receive final knowledge about our children, nor should we exercise total control. We merely receive intuitions, broad images of what they are going to do with their lives, although I bet your mother wasn't far wrong about you. I laughed. She was right, of course. So, you can see where all this is leading. We know that while the mother and father are intuiting how the child will use the wisdom the child will find with them, and then stretch it further, the unborn soul is doing the same thing in a pre-life vision of what it wants to accomplish. Next comes the conception process. She looked at me for a moment. Do you remember the couple we saw at the waterfall?
Yes.
What do you think about that?
It seemed to be very deliberate.
That's right. It was. Once a couple decides to attempt conception, to bring in a soul they intuit, the physical act is a kind of merging of energy fields that in a very real way, orgasmically, opens a gate into heaven and allows the soul in. I thought about what I had seen at the waterfall. The couple's energy merged and a new energy began to grow. In the materialistic mindset of science and the outer cultures, she went on, the sexual union has been reduced to mere biology, just a physical act. But here, we know the spiritual energy of what is really going on. The two merge their energy fields into one, and the child was a product of the merger. Again, science prefers to think of conception as a random combining of genes, and certainly it looks like that when superficially studied in a test tube. In actuality, however, the genes of the mother and father combine to make a child whose characteristics are synchronistic with the best destinies of all three people. Do you see? The child has an intended destiny that he or she visualizes in a pre-life vision, and the genes combine in a precise way to give the child the tendencies and talents needed to fulfill this vision. Scientists in the outer cultures will eventually find a way to confirm this process. That's why the physical recombining of genes by scientists and doctors is so dangerous. Helping to combat disease is one thing, but recombining to increase intelligence or talent, or just because of preference, comes from the ego and can be disastrous. This practice alone led to the destruction of some early civilizations. My point, she concluded, is that here in Shambhala, we take the parenting process very seriously. In its ideal form, the parent's intuition and the child's intuition work together to give the child the best preparation for accomplishing his or her life purpose. What she was saying made me think again of the missing conceptions occurring in Shambhala. What do you think is happening to conceptions that have been disappearing here? I asked. She shrugged, glancing at the closed door of Tashi's room. I don't know, but perhaps we will find out from Tashi's father. Another question came to mind, so I asked, I don't understand who goes to the temples and who stays in the rings. She laughed. I suppose it is quite confusing. Our culture is divided into those who teach and those who are called to the temples. Many of those who are at the temples, though, come back and forth every few days to maintain relationships, especially if they have children. The situation can change at any time based on intuition. Those who work at the temples can come back to teach, and those who have been teaching will go to the temples. It is all very fluid and synchronistic. She paused for a moment, and I nodded for her to continue. Next in the life process is helping a child to wake up. Remember, each of us forgets to some degree why we came here, what we intended to do with our lives. So the child must be given the historical circumstances that surround the event of his birth. What's important is to give the child a context for life so that he knows what has occurred before he arrived and where he fits in. That includes the personal history of his family back several generations. These we keep on a recorder, similar to a videotape, except that it is stored electronically. Tashi, for instance, was able to watch his relatives back seven generations telling him about their lives, what their dreams had been, what worked and didn't work, and at the end of their lives, what they would have done differently. All this is immensely important information for a youngster to hear from relatives. It helps younger people chart the course of their own lives by learning from the mistakes and building on the wisdom of those who came before. Tashi has learned much from many of his ancestors, although his favorite relative is still his grandmother. I was amazed. Recording relatives is a great idea. I wonder why we don't take the time to do this back home. You don't take the time because you still postpone talking about death until the very last minute, and then often it's too late. And life in the outer cultures is still focused too much on the material, not on the life process itself. This will become easier as time goes by and the outer cultures begin to sustain their vibrancy and learn the prayer extensions. Right now, you still reduce life to the ordinary, to the mundane, when in fact, it is a constantly mysterious, informative process. She looked at me as though there were some deeper meaning behind her last statement. You yourself have to overcome this tendency and stay focused on the process of what is happening to you. You have reached Shambhala at a time when it is going into transition. Tashi's father is here to talk to Tashi about his future and the situation at the temples. Yet Tashi doesn't feel intuitively led to go to the temples. Instead, he's interested in going to your world. And you show up right in the middle of this. It all means something.
As though to punctuate what Ani had just said, we both heard a faint roaring sound in the distance, which quickly disappeared.
She looked confused. That's nothing I've ever heard before.
A chill went through me. I think it might be a helicopter, I said. Again, I thought about telling her about my dream, but before I could, she began talking again.
We have to hurry, she said. You have to know who we are, the culture we've created. We were talking about the importance of young people understanding the sequence of generations that came before them. This history is something that all individuals in the Outer Rings become aware of at an early age, as they wake up to their own spirituality and sense of what they came here to do. She raised her finger. Everyone here is clear that the human world evolves through the succession of generations. One generation establishes a way of life and meets certain challenges, and the next generation comes along and extends that worldview. Unfortunately, in the outer cultures, this evolution is just beginning to be taken seriously. More frequently, what occurs is that parents want children to be just like them, to take the same view of everything. This desire is natural in a way, because we all want our children to reinforce the choices we have made. But often the process becomes antagonistic. The parents criticize the interests of the children, and the children criticize the old-fashioned ways of the parents. To some degree, it is part of the process. Children look at the lives of the parents and think, "I like most of how they live, but I would have done certain things differently." All children have a sense of what is incomplete in their parents' way of life. After all, that's the system. We choose our parents in part to be awakened to what is missing, to what needs to be added to human understanding, and we begin that process by being dissatisfied with what we find in our lives with them. Yet, all of this doesn't have to be antagonistic. Once we know the life process, we can participate consciously. Parents can be open to the criticisms of their children and be supportive of their dreams. Of course, doing this causes the parents to have to stretch their own ways of thinking and evolve along with their children, which can be difficult. She looked at me mischievously. Doesn't your Bible say, out of the mouths of babes will come the kingdom of heaven? I had heard that before. She was going out of her way to make the process of evolution very clear to me. I asked a few more questions, and she spent another 10 minutes giving me the details of life in the outer rings of Shambhala. She explained that once children gained an understanding of history and family, the next step was for them to learn to extend their creative prayer field just as I had. They then went on to find a way to advance the culture, either teaching in the outer rings or using their prayer field at the temples. This will eventually be the lifestyle in the outer cultures as well, she added. Some will be devoted to the teaching of children, and others will enter the many institutions of human culture and help move them toward the spiritual ideal. I was about to ask more about what they did at the temples when the door to Tashi's room swung open. Tashi came out, followed by his father. Father wants to see you, Tashi said, looking at me. The older man bowed slightly, and Tashi introduced us, then both sat down at the table. Tashi's father was dressed in the traditional sheepskin pants and vest of a Tibetan herdsman, except that his clothing was immaculately clean and a light tan color. He was short and stocky, and looked at me with kind eyes and an expression of boyish enthusiasm. "You know that Shambhala is about to go into transition?" he asked. I looked at Ani, and then back at him. "Only what some of the legends say." "The legends say," the older man replied, "that at the precise time in the evolution of Shambhala and the outer cultures, a great shift will occur. This shift can only happen when the level of awareness in the outer cultures has reached a particular point. But when it does, Shambhala will move.
Move where? I asked. Do you know? He smiled.
No one knows exactly.
His statement filled me with a wave of anxiety for some reason and a slight dizziness. For a moment, I had a hard time focusing my eyes.
He's still not that strong yet, Ani said.
Tashi's father looked at me.
I'm here because of my intuition that it is important that Tashi join us at the temples during this transition. The legends say it will be a time of great opportunity, but also of dire peril. For a time, what we have been doing here in the temples will be disrupted. We will not be able to help as much.
He looked over at his son.
This will happen just as the situation in the outer cultures becomes critical. Many times during the hidden history of mankind, humans have developed spiritually to this point and then have lost their way and fallen back into ignorance. They began to misuse their technology, disrupting the natural course of evolution. For instance, right now, in the outer cultures, some people are taking the natural process of food and distorting it by genetically manipulating seeds to have unnatural characteristics. This is primarily done in order to patent these seeds and control them in the marketplace. The same thing is occurring in the pharmaceutical industries, where a known herbal remedy, free to all, is genetically altered in order to sell it. In the precise energy system of the body, these manipulations can have terrible consequences on health. The same is true of irradiated foods, chlorine and other additives to the water supply, not to mention so-called designer drugs. At the same time, the technology of the media has reached a point where it can have dramatic influence. If it responds only to the needs of corporations and corrupt politicians, it can create realities for humans that are distorted and unnatural. As corporations merge so that they control more and more of the technology and want to use more advertising to create false needs, this problem will grow. Most imperative is the situation of government power and surveillance, even in the democratic countries. Citing a need to combat drug dealers or terrorists, the government has infringed more and more on the privacy of the common man. Already, cash transactions are being restricted and the internet fully monitored. The next step will be forcing the move to a cashless society controlled by a central authority. This growth toward a central, spiritless governmental authority in a high-tech virtual world divorced from natural processes, where food, water, and the routines of living have been trivialized and distorted, leads to disaster. When health is subverted into just one more commercial cycle of worsening food, new diseases, and more drugs, Armageddon is the result, and it has occurred several times in prehistory. It could happen again, only this time on a much larger scale. He smiled over at Ani. But it need not happen. In fact, we are one small step in awareness from turning the corner. If we could just move fully into the idea that we are spiritual beings in a spiritual world, then food, health, technology, media, and government would all move into their proper roles in the evolution and perfection of this world. But for this to happen, the prayer extensions must be completely understood in the outer cultures. They must understand what we do at the temples. The transition of Shambhala is part of this process, but the opportunity has to be seized. He looked deeply at Tashi. For this to happen, your generation must merge with the last two into an integrated prayer field, one that includes a final unity of all the religions. Tashi looked confused, and his father moved closer to him. All over the world, the generation born in the first decades of the 20th century what our friend from the West would call the World War II generation, used courage and technology to save democracy and freedom from the threat of dictators seeking empire. They won using technological might and continued to expand this technology into a worldwide economy. Then the next generation, what Americans call baby boomers, arrived on the earth, and their intuitions told them that the focus on materialism, on technology alone, was not quite correct, that there was too much pollution, too much corporate influence on government, too much surveillance by the intelligence organizations. This criticism was the normal way that a new generation expands and intuitively leads us forward. They grew up in a hard-won materialism, or in some countries, the desire for the material, and began to react, to voice the idea that there was more to life. There was a spiritual purpose behind human history that could be grasped in more detail. That's what was behind all that happened in the 60s and 70s in the West, the rejection of a material-based system of status, the exploration of other religions, the popularity of philosophy, the explosion in thought of the human potential movement. It was all as the result of a series of insights that there was more to life than our material worldview knew. He regarded me with a twinkle, as though he knew everything about my experiences with the insights. The intuitions of the baby boomers were very important, he went on, because they began to put technology and material abundance into perspective and to grasp the deep intuition that technology is being developed on this planet to support a culture where we can focus not just on surviving, but on our spiritual development as well. He paused for a moment. And now, since the late 70s and into the 80s, a new generation had been arriving to push human culture even further. He looked at Tashi. You and your age group are the final members of this generation. Do you see what emphasis you are bringing into the world? As Tashi pondered the inquiry, I thought about the question myself. The sons and daughters of the boomers have been characterized as reacting to the boomers' idealism and ambivalence toward technology by becoming more practical, and in fact, developing a love for technology beyond anything seen before. Everyone looked at me as though they had heard my thoughts. Tashi was nodding in agreement. We sensed that technology has a spiritual purpose, he said. Now, the older Tibetan continued, looking at all of us. Do you see how the three generations flow together? The World War II generation fought against tyranny and proved that democracy could not only flourish in the modern world, but expand tremendously and connect the world's economies. Then, in the middle of the abundance, the boomers arrived to say that there were problems with this expansion, that we were polluting the natural world and losing touch with nature, and the spiritual reality that exists beneath the whims of history. And now, the next generation has come along to focus again on the economy, to refashion technology so that it can consciously support our mental and spiritual ability, the way it has occurred here in Shambhala, instead of allowing technology to fall solely into the hands of those who would use it to restrict freedom and control others. But this new generation isn't fully conscious of what they are doing, I said. No, not completely, he replied. But this self-awareness and insight is expanding every day. We must set a prayer field that lifts them in this direction. It must be a large and strong field. The new generation must help us unify the religions. This is very important, because there will always be controllers ready to manipulate this generation into creating negative uses for technology, or taking advantage of their alienation. As we sat there, we all heard the low drone of helicopters again, still far in the distance. The transition is beginning, Tashi's father said, looking at him. There are many preparations to make. I want you only to convey that the generation you represent must now help push all of us forward. You, personally, have some role in expanding into the outer cultures what Shambhala has been doing, but only you can decide what you must do. The young man looked away. His father went over and put his arm around him for a moment. Then he embraced Ani and left the house. Tashi followed him with his eyes as he walked to the door and returned alone to his room. I followed Ani out into a sitting area in the garden, full of questions. Where did Tashi's father go? I asked. He's getting ready for the transition, she replied, glancing back at me. This may not be easy. We may all be displaced for a while. There are many who are coming back from the temples and helping. I shook my head. What do you think will happen? No one knows, she replied. The legends are not specific. All we know is that there will be a transition. The uncertainty began to diminish my energy level again, and I sat down on one of the benches nearby. Ani followed and sat beside me. I do know what you must do, she said. You must continue to pursue the rest of the fourth extension. Everything else will take care of itself. I nodded half-heartedly. Focus on what you have learned here. You have seen how technology must evolve, and you have now begun to see how our culture focuses itself on the life process, the miracle of birth and conscious evolution. You know that this is the focus that creates the most inspiration and the most fun. The materialistic life in the outer cultures pales when compared to it. We are spiritual beings, and our lives must revolve around the mysteries of family and talent and the search for individual mission. Again, you now know what such a culture looks and feels like. The legends say that knowing with certainty how the outer cultures can evolve extends everyone's prayer field and gives it more power. Now when you connect within and see your field flowing out in front of you, acting to bring synchronicity and uplifting others into the synchronistic process, you can do so with greater expectation because you know with certainty where this process is taking us all, if we stay true to it and avoid fear and hate. She was right. The extensions were all falling into place. But I haven't seen it all, I said. She looked deeply into my eyes. No, you must continue to understand the rest of the fourth extension. There is more. Your prayer field can become more powerful yet. At that moment, we could hear the helicopters again, and the sound of them filled me with anger. They seemed to be getting closer. How is this possible? How could they know where Shambhala was? Damn them, I said, which produced a horrified look on Ani's face. You have much anger, she said. Well, it's hard not to be angry when you realize what the Chinese military is doing. This anger is a pattern in you. I'm sure you have been warned of its effect. I thought back to all Yin had tried to explain. Yes, I have. I just keep messing up. I could tell she was concerned. You'll have to master this problem, she said. But don't get down on yourself too much. That sends out a negative prayer that keeps you where you are. On the other hand, you can't just ignore your anger. You must keep the problem in mind, remind yourself, stay conscious, and at the same time, set your prayer field that you will break through and discard the old pattern. I knew that was a very fine line to walk and would take conscious work on my part. What should I do now? I asked. What do you think? I've got to go to the temples? Is that your intuition? I thought again about my dream and finally told her about it. Her eyes grew wide. You dreamed of going to the temples with Tashi? She asked. Yeah, I replied. Well, don't you think you should tell him about it? She said sternly. I walked up to Tashi's room and touched the wall. Come in, he said, and an opening appeared. Tashi was stretched out on his bed. He immediately sat up and gestured to a chair across from him. I sat down. For a moment he was silent, the weight of the world on his shoulders. Finally he said, I still don't know what to do.
What are you thinking? I asked.
I don't know. I'm confused. All I can think of is getting to the outer cultures. My mother says I must find my own way. I wish my grandmother was here.
Where is your grandmother?
She's at the temples, somewhere. We stared at each other for a long time, and then he added, If only I could understand this dream I had.
I sat straight up. What dream?
I'm with another group of people. I can't see their faces, but I know that one of them is my sister.
He paused for a moment.
I could also see a place with water. Somehow I'd gotten to the outer cultures.
I've had a dream too, I said.
You were with me. We were at one of the temples. It was blue, and we found someone else there.
A trace of a smile crossed Tashi's face.
What are you saying? He asked. That I'm supposed to go to the temples instead of to the outer cultures?
No, I said, that's not what I mean. You told me that everyone thinks it's impossible to get to the outer cultures through the temples.
But what if it's not? His face lit up. You mean, go to the temples and try to get to the outer cultures from there? I just looked at him. That must be it, he said, standing up. Perhaps I have been called after all.
9. The Energy of Evil. No sooner had we walked out of the bedroom than the sounds of the helicopters in the distance increased. Ani came into the house and pulled out 3 heavy backpacks from a storage bin. She handed them to us along with 2 parkas. I noticed that they seemed to have been conventionally made with cloth and stitching. I was about to ask about them, but she quickly ushered us out of the dwelling and led us down the path to our left. As we walked, Ani moved up beside Tashi, and I could hear him telling her about his decision to go to the temples. The rumblings from the helicopters were coming ever closer, and the blue sky had now turned into a thick overcast. At one point, I asked her where we were heading.
To the caves, she said. You'll need some time to prepare.
We walked down a rocky path which traversed the side of a sheer cliff and onto a plateau on the other side. Here, Ani waved us into a small gully where we huddled, listening. The helicopters moved in a small circle over the cliffs for a moment and followed our path exactly until they were directly over us. Ani looked horrified. What's happening? I yelled. Without answering, she climbed out of the gully and motioned for us to follow. We ran perhaps half a mile across the plateau and into another hilly area, and then stopped and waited. As before, the helicopters circled behind us until they arrived directly overhead. A gust of frigid air hit us, almost knocking me over. At the same time, all of the clothes disappeared from our bodies except for the heavy coats.
I thought this might happen, Ani said, pulling more clothes from the packs.
I still had my boots on, but Tashi's and Ani's had disappeared. She gave him a pair made of leather and put on another herself. When we finished, we made our way up the slope, climbing between the rocks until we arrived at a flatter area. A heavy snow shower was beginning and the temperature was falling. The helicopters seemed to have lost their way for the moment. I looked out on the once green valley. Snow had covered almost everything, and the plants already seemed to be withering from the cold.
It's the effect of the soldier's energy, Ali said. It is destroying our environmental field.
Glancing toward the sound of the helicopters, I felt a new surge of anger. They banked immediately and headed straight toward us.
Let's go, Ani shouted.
I moved up closer to the small fire, feeling the morning chill. We had walked for another hour and spent the night in a small cave. In spite of several layers of insulated undergarments, I was still freezing. Tashi was now huddled up beside me, and Ani was looking out through the opening at the frozen world outside. The snow had been falling for hours.
It's all gone now, Ani said. There's nothing out there now but ice. I moved over to the opening and looked out. What was once a wooded valley with hundreds of dwellings was now nothing but snow and jagged mountains. Here and there were the bent-over remains of trees, but not a spot of color could be seen. All the houses had simply vanished, and the river that ran through the center of the valley was frozen over. "The temperature must have fallen 60 degrees, Ani said. "What happened?" I asked. "When the Chinese found us, the power of their thoughts and their expectations of frigid weather counteracted the field that we had set to keep the temperature moderate. Ordinarily, the strength of the fields provided by those at the temples would have been strong enough to have kept the Chinese away altogether. But they knew it was time for the transition."
"What? They let them in on purpose?"
"It was the only way. If you and the others who have found us were allowed in, there was no way to keep out the soldiers. You are not strong enough to keep all negative thoughts out of your mind, and the Chinese have followed you here."
"You mean this is my fault?" I said.
"It's okay. It is part of the dispersal."
I wasn't consoled. I moved back to the fire, and Ani followed. Tashi had prepared a stew of dried vegetables.
"You must realize," she said, "that everything is all right with the people of Shambhala. All this was expected. Everyone who was here is fine. Enough people came back from the temples to take them through the spatial windows to a new place of safety. Our legends have prepared us well." She pointed out toward the valley. "You must focus on what you're doing. You and Tashi have to make it to the temples without being captured by the military. The rest of what Shambhala has been doing for humanity must be known." She stopped as we both heard the faint rumblings of a distant helicopter. The sound grew fainter and finally disappeared. "And you must be much more careful," she said. "I thought you knew not to allow negative images into your mind, especially hateful or disparaging thoughts." I knew she was right, but I still felt confused about how all that worked. She looked hard at me. "Sooner or later, you're going to have to deal with your pattern of anger." I was about to ask a question when out through the cave opening we saw several dozen people walking down an icy slope to our right. Ani stood up and looked at Tashi. "There is no more time," she said. "I have to go. I have to help these people find a way out. Your father will be waiting on me." "Can't you come with us?" Tashi asked, moving closer to her. I could see that he had tears in his eyes. Ani stared at him and looked out at the icy crevice of the other people. "I can't," she said, hugging him tightly. "My place is here, helping with the transition. But don't worry. I'll find you wherever you are." She walked toward the mouth of the cave and turned around to face both of us. "You will be fine," she said. "But be careful. You cannot keep your energy up if you are overwhelmed with anger. You must have no enemies." She stopped and looked at me, and then said something I had heard many times on this journey. "And remember," she instructed, smiling, "you are being helped." Tashi looked over his shoulder and smiled at me as we trudged through the deep snow. It was getting colder, and I struggled to maintain my energy. To reach the mountain range holding the temples, we had to climb down the ridge we were on, cross the frozen valley, and climb almost straight up and over another mountain. We had made our way down almost a quarter of a mile without difficulty, but now seemed to be reaching the edge of a rock precipice. Below was a sheer drop-off of almost 50 feet. Tashi turned and looked at me. "We'll have to slide down it. There's no way around." "That's too dangerous," I protested. "There might be rocks just under the snow. If we start sliding out of control, we could be hurt." My energy was plummeting. Tashi smiled nervously. "It's okay," he said. "It's okay to be afraid. Just maintain your visualization of a positive outcome. Fear will actually bring the Dakini closer." "Wait a minute," I said. "No one ever mentioned that before. What do you mean?" Haven't you been helped mysteriously, inexplicably?
Yen told me Shambhala was helping me.
Well?
I don't understand the relationship. I've been trying to find out what determines when the Dakini help us.
Only those in the temples know that. I just know that fear always brings these guardians closer, if we can still maintain our faith to some degree. It is hate that drives them away.
Tashi pulled me forward off the ledge, and we began to slide in the loose snow uncontrollably. My foot hit a rock and flipped me over, and I began rolling head over heels. I knew if my head hit another rock, it could be all over. But in spite of the fear, I managed to hold a vision of landing safely. With that thought, a particular feeling began to come over me, and I was filled with a sense of peace and well-being. The terror subsided. Moments later, I hit the bottom of the drop-off and rolled to a stop. Tashi slammed into my back. I lay for a moment with my eyes closed. I opened them, slowly, remembering other dangerous situations in my life when an inexplicable peace had come over me. Tashi was pulling himself out of the snowbank, and I smiled over at him.
What?
He asked. Someone was here. Tashi stood up and shook the snow off his clothes and began to walk on. You see what happens when you stay positive? Whatever temporary strength comes from anger cannot compare with this mystery. I nodded, hoping I could remember that. For 2 hours we made our way across the valley floor, crossing the frozen river and working our way up the gradual slope to the base of the steep mountains. The snow was beginning to fall harder. Suddenly, Tashi stopped.
Something moved up ahead, he said.
I strained to see.
What was it?
It looked like a person.
Come on.
We proceeded up the slope of the mountain. Its peak looked to be about 2,000 feet above us.
There has to be a pass somewhere, Tashi said. We can't go over the top.
Ahead of us we heard the sound of sliding snow and rocks. Tashi and I glanced at each other and moved slowly around a series of large outcroppings. As we made our way past the last one, we could see a man shaking himself out of the snow. He looked exhausted. A bloody bandage was wrapped around one of his knees. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was Will.
It's okay, I said to Tashi. I know this man.
I stood up and crawled over the rocks. Will heard us and dived to the side, ready in spite of his leg to run down a narrow draw away from us.
It's me, I called to him.
Will stood up tall for a moment, then collapsed again in the snow. He was dressed in a thick white parka and insulated pants.
It's about time, he said, smiling. I was expecting you earlier.
Tashi rushed over and looked at Will's leg. I introduced them. As quickly as I could, I explained to Will everything that had happened to me. Meeting Yen, fleeing the Chinese, learning the extensions, getting through the gateway, and finally, reaching the rings of Shambhala. I didn't know how to find you, I added, pointing down the valley. Everything's been ruined. It's the effect of the Chinese.
I know, Will said. I've already run into them myself.
Will went on to tell us about his experiences. Like me, he had extended his prayer field the best he could and been allowed into Shambhala. He'd been in another part of the rings, where he was educated further in the legends by another family. The temples are very difficult to reach, Will said, especially now with the Chinese soldiers coming. We must make sure we are not engaging in negative prayer.
I don't seem to be doing so well in that area, I replied.
He looked at me sharply, concerned. But that's why you were with Yen. Didn't he show you what can happen?
I think I understand how to avoid the general fear images. It's my anger against the Chinese soldiers that keeps slipping me up.
Will looked even more alarmed and was about to say something when we heard the sounds of helicopters closing in the distance. We began our climb up the mountain, weaving our way through the rocks and deep snowbanks. Everything seemed to be very fragile and unstable. We climbed for another 20 minutes without talking. The wind was increasing now, and the snow stung against our faces. Will stopped and dropped to one knee. Listen, he said. What's that?
It's the helicopter again, I said, fighting my irritation. As we listened, the helicopter sliced through the overhanging clouds and began to fly straight toward us. Limping slightly, Will made his way farther up the icy slope, but I paused for an instant, hearing something else above the noise of the helicopter. It sounded like a freight train.
Look out! Will screamed from ahead of me. It's an avalanche!
I tried to run out of the way, but it was too late. The full force of the rolling snow hit me in the face and knocked me backward down the slope. I was tumbling and sliding, sometimes covered completely by the weight of the thundering avalanche, sometimes riding on the surface of the moving mass. After what seemed like forever, I felt myself come to a stop. I was packed in, unable to move, my body in a contorted position under the snow. I tried to suck in a breath, but there was no air. I knew I was about to die. But someone grabbed my outstretched arm and began to dig me out. I could feel others digging around me, and finally my head was free. I gasped for air, wiping the snow from my eyes, expecting to see Will. Instead, I saw a dozen Chinese soldiers, one of them still holding my arm. In the background, walking toward me was Colonel Chang. Without talking, he signaled several of the other soldiers to take me to a hovering helicopter. A rope ladder was dropped, and some of the soldiers swiftly climbed aboard, then threw down a harness which was placed around me. The colonel gave the order, and I was hauled aboard as he and the remaining soldiers climbed in. In minutes, we were flying away. I stood, looking out a porthole-sized window of a 30-by-30-foot insulated tent. Altogether, I could count at least 7 large tents and 3 small, portable trailers of a size that could be airlifted easily. A gasoline generator hummed at the corner of the compound, and I could see several helicopters sitting in an area to the left. The snow had stopped falling, but had accumulated 12 or 14 inches on the ground. I strained to see to the right. From the lay of the mountain range in the background, I concluded that I had been flown only as far back as the center of the valley. A nighttime wind howled, flapping the outside seams of the tent. When I had arrived, I had been fed, forced to take a lukewarm shower, and given warm Chinese fatigues and insulated underwear to put on. At least I was finally warm. I turned around and looked over at the armed Chinese guard sitting at the entrance. His eyes had been following my every move with a cold, icy stare that chilled my soul. Fatigued, I walked over and sat down on one of the 2 army cots in the corner. I tried to assess my situation, but I couldn't think. I was numb, petrified, so fearful, in fact, that I knew I wasn't very alert. I couldn't understand why I felt so incapacitated. It was a panic as intense as any I had ever experienced. I tried to take a deep breath and build energy, but I couldn't even get started. The bare light bulbs hanging from the tent ceiling filled the room with a dull, flickering light and ominous shadows. I could find no beauty anywhere around me. The flap of the tent opened up, and the soldier stood up at attention. Colonel Chang walked in and took off his thick parka, nodding to the guard. He then focused on me. I looked away. "We must talk," he said, pulling a folding chair over and sitting 4 feet away. "I must have the answers to my questions. Now." He stared at me coldly for a moment. "Why are you here?" I decided to answer as truthfully as I could. "I'm here studying Tibetan legend. I told you that." "You're here looking for Shambhala." I was silent. "Is that it?" he asked. "Is it in this valley?" The fear churned in my stomach. What would he do if I refused to answer? "Don't you know?" I asked. He smiled slightly. "I would guess that you and the rest of your illegal sect think this is Shambhala." He looked puzzled, as though remembering something else. "We've glimpsed other people here, but they have managed to elude us in the snow. Where are they?"
Where did they go?
I don't know, I said. I don't even know where we are.
He shifted toward me. We have also found the remains of plants recently alive. How is that possible? How could they have grown here?
I just stared.
He grinned coldly. How much do you really know about the legends of Shambhala?
A little, I stammered.
I know a lot. Do you believe that?
By now, I've had access to all the ancient writings, and I must say they are delightfully interesting as mythology. Think about it. An ideal community made up of enlightened human beings that are far more advanced mentally than any other culture on this planet. And I know the rest, too. This idea that these individuals of Shambhala somehow have a secret power for good that permeates all the rest of humanity and pushes them in that direction. Fascinating stuff, don't you think? Ancient lore that could even be appreciated, for that matter, if it weren't so misleading and dangerous to the people of Tibet. Don't you think if anything like that were real, we would have discovered it by now? God, spirit, it's all a childish dream. Take the Tibetan mythology about the Dakini, the idea that there are angel beings who can interact with us, help us.
What do you believe in? I asked, trying to defuse the situation.
He pointed to his head. I believe in the powers of the mind. This is why you should talk to me. Help us. We are most interested in the idea of psychic power, the greater range of brainwaves and their effect on electronics and people at a distance. But don't confuse this with spiritualism. The powers of mind are a natural phenomenon that can be researched and discovered scientifically.
He ended his statement with an angry gesture with his hand, sending a deepening pang of fear through my stomach. I knew this man was extremely dangerous and absolutely remorseless. He was looking at me, but something attracted my attention along the wall of the tent behind him, directly across from the door where the guard was standing. The area had suddenly gotten brighter. The light bulb overhead flickered slightly, and I dismissed my perception as a surge from the generator. The colonel got up and walked a few steps toward me, looking more angry.
Do you think I like journeying out here into this wasteland? How anyone survives out here is beyond me, but we are not leaving. We are going to enlarge this camp until we have enough troops to cover this whole area on foot. Whoever is here will be found and dealt with very harshly.
He forced a half smile.
But our friends will be equally rewarded. Do you understand?
At this moment, another wave of fear rushed through me, but it was different. It was a fear mixed with a great disdain. I was beginning to loathe the extent of this man's evil. I glanced behind him to the area that seemed lighter, but it was now flat and filled with shadows. The lightness had disappeared, and I felt totally alone.
Why are you doing this? I asked. The Tibetan people have a right to their own religious beliefs. You're trying to destroy their culture. How can you do this?
I could feel my anger making me stronger. My confrontation seemed only to energize him.
Oh, you do have opinions, he smirked. Too bad they are so naive. You think what we are doing is unusual. Your own government is developing ways of controlling you, too. Chips that can be inserted into the body of troops and unsuspecting troublemakers. And that's not all. He was almost shouting now. We know now that when people think, a specific pattern of brainwaves radiates outward. Every government is working on machines that can identify these brainwaves, especially angry or anti-government sentiment.
His statement chilled me. He was talking about the same misuse of brainwave amplification that Ani had warned me about, the ones that had doomed some early civilizations to ruin. Do you know why your so-called democratic governments are doing this? He went on. Because they are far more afraid of the people than we are. Our citizens know the role of government is to govern. They know that certain liberties have to be limited. Your people think there can be individual self-direction. Well, if that was true in the past, in a highly technical world where a suitcase weapon can destroy a city, it cannot work any longer. With that kind of freedom, humans will not survive. The direction, the values of society must be controlled and directed for the greater good. That's why this Shambhala legend is so dangerous. It is based on absolute self-direction. As he talked, I thought I heard the door open behind me, but I didn't turn around. I was focused totally on this man's attitude. Here was the worst of modern tyranny being voiced, and the more he talked, the more my loathing increased.